1, 2, 3, 4.
What is the future of literature in the age of generative AI? How can bookstores build community and be engines for positive social change?
Denny Kane is the author of the poetry collections Continental Breakfast, Eldorado Freddy's, Flavortown, and Picture Window, as well as the books How to Protect Bookstores and Why, and How to Resist Amazon and Why. His poetry has appeared in The Slowdown, Lit Hub, Diagram, Had, and Barrel House. He's a co-owner of The Raven Bookstore, Publishers Weekly's 2022 Bookstore of the Year.
Denny Kane, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thanks. I'm so glad to be here.
So we're speaking on the publication of your latest book, How to Protect Bookstores and Why. Before we dive into the conversation, I believe you've selected a passage to share with our listeners.
This is just a couple excerpts from the introduction. Do bookstores even need to be protected? I can easily imagine some bookstore owners or workers saying no. After all, a bookstore, a for-profit business, doesn't need protection in the same way that, say, civil rights do. A business must figure out how to make money to stay open, so if a bookstore fails, that seems like a business problem, not a social, political, or cultural problem. We're talking stores, not museums, right? On top of that, a lot of bookstores aren't failing at all. By many indicators, the number of bookstores in America is increasing. Some people have even suggested that America is in the midst of an indie bookstore renaissance. If that's the case, why worry about protecting bookstores? This is a great question and one that this book sets out to answer. To do this, though, I first need to break it down into two separate questions. Why are bookstores worth protecting, and why do bookstores need protecting? To start, a bookstore's value resides in the benefits it provides to its community. Bookstores provide economic benefits in the same way that any independently owned retail business does. A central district with several thriving small businesses is an economic boon to any city. Such concentration of small businesses draws tourists, locals, and workers who spend and earn money that's more likely to stay local. According to a 2022 report by the American Booksellers Association, independent businesses provide their communities with substantial, quantifiable economic benefits relative to their chain competitors as they distribute profits to local ownership, employ a variety of personnel that might otherwise reside at a distant corporate office, routinely purchase goods and services from other local businesses, and generously support local charitable causes. In addition, bookstores can also introduce members of their communities to social movements. There's a rich history of radical, activist, and feminist bookstores that serve as a durable entry point into political engagement. In this way, a bookstore is actually more than space facilitating the exchange of goods for money. As Kimberly Kinder writes in her book, The Radical Bookstore, Counter Space for Social Movements, activists operating bookstores and info shops rarely maintain single-use storefronts. Instead, they treat the space as an enabling resource sustaining many functions through continual repurposing. Selling books is a function of these bookstores, yes, but so are lots of other things. A crucial element of bookstores is permanence. While a protest can last a few hours, a radical bookstore can last decades. Kinder calls radical bookstores constructed spaces that find a home in retail and that leverage the durability and porosity of retail to advance political causes. As she writes, having autonomous space instead of relying only on seized or borrowed space constructs additional opportunities for organizing. Because bookstores are permanent or semi-permanent spaces, activists can easily use them to advance their causes and welcome new activists into the fold.
Yeah, it's a radical act. I've noticed that independent bookstore owners are, of course, very independently minded and kind of maverick. And what this book does so well is you go around a lot of bookstores in your general region, but also my city in Paris. You came to Shakespeare and Company just around the corner. And I love this metaphor that the world is like a book and the countries are like chapters, and you give the kind of people behind the bookstores, the communities. And that's definitely something that you don't get from Amazon. You know, before we go into those different bookstore stories, just tell us about your journey to becoming a bookseller yourself at The Raven. You were a teacher.
Yeah, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, but I moved to Lawrence, Kansas to get an MFA in poetry at the University of Kansas. And while I was working on that degree, I had the honor of getting a part-time job bookselling at the Raven Bookstore, which I just fell in love with as soon as I got to Lawrence. And then once I started working at it, I fell in love with it even more and fell in love with the bookselling industry in general. And then as I worked towards finishing my degree it became clear that the owner of the store was thinking about retiring, and it just felt like an undeniable opportunity for me, a chance to do something really, really cool that I had never even dreamed of. And so we worked out a way for me to take over the store, and then that was it. It was off to the races. But yeah, I had planned on being a teacher for the rest of my life, or a writer. I still am a writer, but book selling I kind of fell into, and it just captured my imagination and my heart as soon as I started working at the bookstore, because I could see the potential for this great, amazing community-oriented work. Of course, it's a thrill to be around books and to meet authors and to read all this stuff and spend all day with people who love books. But what I think really fell in love with was the sense of community and the people behind it and the way a bookstore can really be an engine for positive social change within its community and in a broader sense as well.
Yeah, and does a great service, I think, supporting those other local businesses, which are all kind of under threat, which you have written, of course, about how to resist Amazon. We're all seeing, whether it's small cities or large cities, being hollowed out by the online revolution, right?
Yeah. The assumption that a lot of people have is that independent retail is just over with, that the bookstore is a thing of the past, that online commerce has kind of taken over, which is a feeling I resist. Like, there's the idea of the third place, the place to go where you can hang out that's not work or home. It's a place where you can exist within your community, form connections to people outside of your family, and basically have a life that's not domestic or professional. And I think that's really, really important. I think those spaces are disappearing. They're disappearing in two ways. One, a lot of third places are commerce oriented, whether they're coffee shops or bookstores or record stores. And it's just the system we live in. A lot of the spaces in public, no matter how community minded, do have to concern themselves with making money. But if you get rid of retail, then that's a whole swath of third spaces that are gone. And Amazon is working on that to get rid of the third space, but they're also working on getting rid of the second space even. They want everything, all economic activity to happen at home. They want you to work at home. They want you to shop at home. And they're taking a lot of steps to turn your home into a site for commerce. You've got Alexa speakers that you can put in your home that make it easier to order things. You've got the doorbells, the Ring doorbells, which they own that you can see, you kind of surveil outside. You've got a refrigerator that's hooked up to the internet that can automatically order things that it notices are empty. And so not only is Amazon going after the third space, they're trying to condense all economic activity into the home, which really isolates people from their communities. And I resist that. And in becoming integrated into the bookstore world, I found a lot of like-minded compatriots who also resist that.
And so what you're saying also is that books, and by extension, bookstores, libraries, all these community-run businesses are under threat, whether it's also the local newspaper and all these things. Opening a bookstore is a radical act. It's also like a mental health service. I think it's a pleasure of the aesthetics of it, but also it's this way to just reconnect with a slower way of thinking and being.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, that's another thing that the big tech companies want to happen is just cheapening journalism and information. Think about when Facebook announced that they were pivoting to video, how many journalist jobs were lost just because of that single decision. And all these newspapers were like, to keep up, we have to make videos now. So we're going to get rid of our reporters. And the pivot to video didn't really pan out, but then the reporters didn't get their jobs back. And you think about the role a local newspaper has in a community, like, as a bookstore, where do books get reviewed? Where do people interview authors? Where do we post announcements about our events? Who covers our big moments? If there's not a journalist in town that's writing articles about arts and culture, it threatens the work of the book in the bookstore as well. And so it's a big fight, but I think it's a fight worth having, that journalism and books and literacy and media literacy are all really important to the health of communities. And I think bookstores are a great site to launch that resistance against the flattening and elimination of all that.
Well, I think we'll maybe save it for later to talk about how our imaginations are being mechanized through AI, but we should be focusing on your book. So just tell us about some of those amazing people.
I knew I didn't want to write the type of book that made it seem like I had all the answers. I've had a writing mentor tell me once that nobody wants to read a book where the author just explains how they're correct. And so with that, I knew the book wasn't going to be about my bookstore, The Raven. I mean, it pops up. I write from the angle of being a bookseller. You can't change that. And that's who I am. But the book really focuses on 12 bookstores and telling their stories and the stories of the people who work there and own them. In part because I think there's no one single answer to, like, what can bookstores do? the answer to that question is so varied and so important that it would be impossible to say that there's just one. There aren't even just 12. And in the conclusion of the book, I kind of gesture to the fact that there's way more than even this. But if a bookstore is rooted in its community, then every community has a different answer to, like, what can a bookstore do in its community? So I decided to hit the road and go talk to people. And I went to Minneapolis to talk to Louise Erdrich, who I'm honored to call a friend. I went to Washington, D.C. to talk to Loyalty Bookstores, whose Drag Story Hour events have come under attack by Proud Boys and far-right folks. I went to Columbus to talk to $2 Radio, who's both publishing and selling really innovative small press books. And I went to Paris because I think France has some really interesting policy mechanisms that protect bookstores at a policy level that aren't present in the United States. And it's like, okay, so Paris has 1,000 bookstores. They're all really great. What is the government doing to make sure that happens? And can we draw policy lessons from that? And so it took me to different countries. It took me all around the U.S. And you're right, it was a really fun book to write, but it was an honor and a privilege to go visit these stores and talk to them and shop their shelves and see what they're all doing and how they're doing it differently or the same.
Yeah, it's true. Like on my street, there's so many bookstores and it's a nice thing. I kind of take it for granted. And I was indirectly introduced to my husband. And this might be a new avenue, I think, for booksellers is matchmaking. You know, like I meet people. But I was introduced to my husband through George Whitman, who you dedicated your book to along with.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, that's great.
That's really cool. I've had some interesting chance encounters in bookstores as well. Yeah, I wanted to jump on this note of community. So I was really wondering while reading a copy of your book, how we can start discussing bookstores with our families and friends who maybe default to Amazon because of convenience or time or pricing, and it's hard to start trying to get them to change. Or how do we talk to friends and family who might be losing hope in the practicality and future of bookstores? How do we start talking to these people close to us and starting these discussions? Especially the reply that, well, you know, I'm just one customer. I can't influence the market anyway. So why are you asking me to change? How do we respond to that comment?
It's a really good question. You said you're at University of Chicago. Seminary Co-op, amazing bookstore. One of the best bookstores in the country. I'm good friends with Jeff, who runs it. And he also has a good book about bookstores called In Praise of Good Bookstores. My whole nonfiction book project started with a tweet thread I posted actually exactly 5 years ago on April 17th, 2019. It was just every bookseller has the ability to have this discussion, like the very discussion you're talking about. A customer comes in, it's like, oh, this book is, you know, 50% off on Amazon. Why should I buy it here? Every bookseller in the world needs to be prepared to have a discussion. You're probably going to have it on your first day at work. And in some ways, when this tweet thread 5 years ago went viral, I started to think about ways to create a resource for that discussion so people have some assets and some easy ways to talk about it. If not the model for talking about it, at the very least, some easy source material that they can use. And so eventually it became a zine first. And I self-published a zine that I was stapling and sending to bookstores for them to put on their front counters to sell for a couple bucks as a way to kind of help bridge that gap. Like booksellers are really good at having this discussion among themselves, but I was interested if I could provide a resource that the discussion could happen across the front counter. And so not to say the answer to your question is buy my books and read them, but the intent is that this is at least one person's way of talking about this in a way that doesn't really alienate or make people feel ashamed. It definitely holds Amazon to task, but it's also a positive story. And I think both books are really trying to show the power of bookstores as well as the dangers of it. And I think having a positive argument in your back pocket will help those discussions. Like, if, for example, you could talk about Amazon's labor practices, and I think you should talk about the privacy stuff, but imagine Hyde Park in Chicago without the Seminary Co-op. What would this neighborhood be? Where would Mia meet her husband if it's not for the booksellers? Having a really positive angle, too, really helps in those discussions. And I think your question about, like, well, I'm just one consumer, what am I going to do, is a really important point as well, because you're right. If I withhold all my purchases from Amazon, statistically, Amazon is so big that it doesn't actually make a difference. They're not going to feel that pinch. I'm not really holding them to the fire or anything because they have 170 million other customers. But if you look at that through a positive stance, who will feel my business is the Seminary Co-op. If I switch from buying a book a month on Amazon to a book a month at Seminary Co-op, that business is small enough and community oriented enough that they absolutely will notice the difference of another regular person in their community. And so I don't think about it quite as much as withholding from Amazon as I do about contributing to these local community-oriented businesses. And that's why the book is called How to Resist and not How to Boycott. Because I think part of the resistance is putting your positive involvement and your money into places that are actively fighting to create the world that Amazon is trying to destroy.
Yeah, thank you for that answer. And yeah, the seminary co-op is quite close to my heart. And since I'm a university student, we've been talking about the on-campus bookstores. I was wondering, how can universities as institutions better support the bookstores around them on campus or near campus?
Yeah, The Raven is a campus bookstore because we're in the same town as the University of Kansas. And we don't sell textbooks or anything. Our relationship with the university isn't quite as official as the seminary co-ops is. But when you're by a huge university, they have so much impact on the intellectual and creative life of the cities that they're in. We are not the official bookseller for the university. I'm not sure we're interested in doing that. But we do have some professors who are friends or customers who will send folks to buy the books for their course at our store. And often these are professors who are intent on teaching their students about the community beyond campus and be like, hey, go downtown, meet these people, spend some time at these businesses. And while you're there, pick up this book for my course. And so they'll give us a call, like order a bunch of these, and we're happy to, and maybe even offer a discount to those students. But there's a lot that individual professors can do like that. And then, you know, universities also bring authors to town. And often the author will appear on campus, you know, where it's hard to park. A lot of times townies, so to speak, are reluctant to go onto campus. And so this event happens on campus, and then the university bookstore is selling the books there. And it's like, we who love books and devote our life to books have nothing to do with this author who's appearing on campus. They like swoop in and swoop out. So I would encourage universities to think about hosting these events in a more public facing way, having the authors speak at a theater in town, having the local bookstore do the book sales for that event, or setting up a separate book signing event at the bookstore in addition to the campus event. Like reaching out to the store and just involving them, I think it's mutually beneficial for everybody. I think the question of who sells books on campus is a really interesting one. Until recently, the KU bookstore sold all books for on-campus author events, and then they just decided to stop doing it. Not through any decree or anything, but we just heard from a department that, hey, the KU bookstore says they can't sell books at this event. Can you do it for us? It's like, I guess we're doing books on campus now. But other schools are still really holding up that monopoly of on-campus book sales. You know, I'm opposed to monopolies of any kind. So that's just one little thing that colleges can do, is think about what vendors are on campus. Does their bookstore have a monopoly on these literary events? So yeah, I know Avid Bookstore, who I wrote about and how to protect bookstores and why, is currently fighting that fight with their campus, the University of Georgia. They're doing some really interesting consumer messaging about this very issue.
Yeah, the bookstore is really part of this greater social fabric of the university. And I feel like who attends these events, how these events are advertised, also speak to the relationship the university has with its surrounding community or the alienation from its community. And just on the greater note of community and policy, you lay out not just individual consumer steps in your books, but also more broad scale policy changes. I remember you at one point in your book talking about the government potentially making it easier to offer health insurance to employees, which is very important. So how do you envision these changes being taken gradually to policymakers?
Yeah, great question. I didn't want to just put this all on the consumer. I think that's one way to derail those discussions you were asking about, is if it makes it feel like it's up to the consumer to defeat Amazon, that's like it's up to the consumer to solve the climate crisis by changing their light bulbs. Nothing's really going to happen until corporate and policy changes take place. It's really frustrating to think about enacting policy on a national level. Like you think about France and the Lang Law, which is passed in 1981. Like that's the reason why Paris and France have so many bookstores, is because there's a piece of policy that's been in place for decades that makes it make economic sense for bookstores to exist. Getting the Lang Law passed in the United States feels impossible, and it might actually be. But I don't want people to get discouraged about federal policy. I think it is absolutely crucial to be in communication with your representatives at a federal level about what's important to you, and not just about bookstores, but about everything else. But a lot of this stuff is local, and it's much easier to move the needle locally than it is federally. And it happens all the time. Amazon will come to a city and be like, we want to build a warehouse here. And the city will be like, great, here's a piece of land that you don't have to pay property taxes on for 30 years. A, what does it mean that a company like Amazon is getting that kind of benefits from the government? And B, why can't the person who wants to start a bookstore get a 30-year tax break too? What is it about Amazon? You know, yes, it's scale, but those are not sustainable jobs. They're dangerous jobs. It's not a great way to build a robust community. And if you're at city council saying this stuff into the microphone, it might actually move the needle. I mean, even right down to like, hey, where do you get your office supplies for City Hall? You get them from Amazon? What about the people here who are selling office supplies? Don't you want the economic activity to stay here? In the States, there's a really big thing with these right-wing hostile takeovers of school and library boards. These groups like Moms for Liberty have this template of how to take over a school board or a library board and get books banned, try to defund public education. And so if it feels impossible to get the Lang Law passed at the federal level, look at what's going on in your community, because local politics is just as important in this fight.
Yeah. I mean, on the note, how many book bans have there been in the last few years? And I don't know what they exactly are for Europe, but there's this strong conservative crusade to constrict children's freedom to read. I think it's close to 1,500 books.
Like, it's more. I think whatever the total was for last year has already been exceeded this year. So we're looking at exponential growth in book challenges and book bans. And it's all part of this greater fight to reshape American education. That's a really important front for resistance as well. The follow-up to the bookstore book, which I'm beginning work on now, is called How to Defend Books and Why. And it's very concerned with this wave of book bans and how access to books and speech is being constrained in this kind of mobilized and organized effort by the right wing.
Yeah, on one hand, I have to keep my mind open to maybe their concerned parents, and it's all confusing times, and maybe it's others who have other xenophobic fears, or you could actually describe it better because I'm just observing it from a distance.
Yeah, I think what's animating a lot of this is that folks in the States want government money to go to private Christian schools. And that seems to be the end game for all of this. And it keeps popping up in these different guises. So you'll see people who are opposed to children's books that have queer characters or characters of color. You'll see it in what they call gender ideology and the resistance to children changing their pronouns, or passing these laws that if a school hears a child changing its pronouns, they have to inform the parents, even if the parents are abusive or even if that creates a dangerous environment for that child. And so it keeps popping up in these culture war fronts. But I think the ultimate goal is these folks want to create schools where only their ideology is present and the children have no exposure to other ideas. And to me, that violates the fundamental idea of education, that exposure to other ideas is a good thing. And if you don't want your child to read a certain book, you have every right to restrict your child's access to that book, but you don't have the right to restrict my child's access to that book. And so what they're doing is they're trying to control access to these books for everybody, not just their own children. And that, to me, is when you get into questions of freedom of speech and the First Amendment. A small group of parents are trying to control access to information for everybody.
Yeah, the bookstore and the library and all these places are places for exploration where you can encounter ideas that are different to your own. And you describe, which I really like, you described bookselling as a human art. And it's much about reading people and connecting them with the books that they might appreciate or maybe would react in a different way to. But it's a psychological skill and it's not just a bookseller. But one thing that we're all considering these days is the rapid advance of AI and the way our reading habits have not just changed where we buy books, but whether people can still find it within themselves to read for pleasure, or maybe you can even outsource your reading to a device to summarize it for you and write your books for you. I wonder what your reflections are on that.
Yeah, I am definitely an AI skeptic, and not even as a bookseller, but as a writer. I really believe in the importance of a human sitting down and putting human thoughts onto a page for other humans. Like, there is a kind of alchemy in not only the selling of books, but in the writing of books, that I'm really skeptical of any technology that thinks it can replace that. And I think the Amazon search algorithm is a great example of this. Like, if you spend time on Amazon's website and you look at, if you like this, you might like this. A lot of times it's just nonsense. And the Amazon search results page is clogged with ads. Like, there's a big problem with AI generated ebooks on Amazon right now. It's hard to tell if you're even buying the right thing or if you're buying something that some bot created. And this is allegedly the most advanced e-commerce site of all time, right? It's a $1 trillion company with access to the most advanced technology in the world. That alone tells me that there's something human about this, especially shopping for books. And Jeff at Seminary Co-op, no one writes better about the human art of bookselling than he does. But in his book, he talks about how it is kind of magic. Like a good book recommendation is truly something I don't think a computer can do yet, because there's so much about what connects with us. It's emotional. We like surprises, but not the wrong kind of surprises. Yeah. So AI, at least in bookselling, I don't think it's coming for bookselling quite yet.
And also, these are well-known bookstores to talk about. Louise Erdrich talking about Amazon in your book. They got what they wanted. They nearly killed it. And she talks about, why don't they just leave us alone? That was their Trojan horse, really. And they don't need bookselling anymore, per se.
Yeah. And it's like, why does someone start a bookstore or buy a bookstore or work at a bookstore? Maybe they love books. Maybe they love community. All of the reasons why someone works at a bookstore are about the advancement of the book and the literary community. These are, I don't know if I would call them pure, perhaps noble, or at least important things. Amazon started selling books because they have ISBN numbers, so they're easy to catalog, and they're rectangular, so they're easy to ship. That was Jeff Bezos' decision. It's like, what can I build a massive inventory of that's easy to ship? Oh, how about books? The average Barnes & Noble has 300,000 books. I could put 3 million books in a warehouse. And now Amazon is so vast and so diversified and so valuable that they truly don't need books anymore, but they still have that business. And the fact that they're in that business is sending ripple effects throughout the entire book industry. And it's not just books. You could say that about a dozen other industries that Amazon is involved in. They come in there and they disrupt and they make it hard for everybody else. And I don't think they're disrupting it for the better.
Well, I guess they're trying to do something about using AI to discover inefficiencies and mitigate climate change. So they always do these kind of things to offset.
Yeah. When I went from the first edition to the second edition of the Amazon book, I added a new chapter about climate change and the environment. And just from what I've found, Amazon likes to tell stories about how they're helping the climate. I'm not sure how well those stories actually hold up. And a lot of it is they really publicly made a climate pledge. And they named the hockey arena in Seattle the Climate Pledge Arena after they bought the rights. But a lot of those metrics just haven't been hit, and they're not keeping their own pledge. Maybe I'm the wrong person to ask about this because I'm naturally skeptical about everything Amazon, but I'm not sure it should be up to the corporations to police themselves on the climate.
Oh, yes, definitely not. We don't know what's happening. But just talk a little bit about some of the different bookstores that you have. As you say, radical bookstores, Black-owned booksellers, and they can serve, they are the community. You really can't get that on Amazon.
Right. And thanks for bringing me back to the positive argument, because that is what I really do want to talk about how great bookstores are. And that's so important. So yeah, you mentioned employee-owned co-ops. That's Red Emma's in Baltimore, which is a fully employee-owned co-op that's been doing it for many, many years. It's an amazing radical bookstore and a delicious coffee shop. They just bought two adjacent buildings in the Waverly neighborhood of Baltimore to really create that kind of lasting permanence that I talked about when I read from the intro. Like, this is an activist space whose activists own the building. That's fully controlled by these great change makers in Baltimore, and they're using it to make Baltimore a better place. And not only that, they've got resources to help other businesses convert to employee-owned co-ops. And that part of their mission is to help spread the gospel of the employee-owned co-op. And they've successfully brought a couple other businesses on board in their neighborhood. I find their work just tremendously inspiring. So that's Red Emma's in Baltimore. I talked to a new Black-owned bookstore and a legacy Black-owned bookstore. The legacy bookstore Source Booksellers in Detroit is the oldest Black-owned bookstore in the Midwest of the United States, owned by a mother and daughter, Janet and Allison Webster Jones. They've been there since 1989 in some form. And that bookstore started as a vendor at festivals. Like, Janet would bring books and sell them from a table. And so she was literally in the community. And as that store has grown from the table to a temporary space to its permanent brick and mortar space, it's very literally an outgrowth of the community, because she started in the community and she still lets that philosophy really govern her, even as Detroit gentrifies and changes around her. They're very dedicated and plugged into their community in a really inspiring way. And it's, you know, 30 plus years. So again, really, really inspiring. I could go on all day, but those are two really cool examples from the book.
Yeah, it's really impressive to me how you build the connections with all of these bookstores around the country. And I was wondering, how did you do that? Did you walk into the store and say, hey, tell me about the story of your bookstore. I would love to know some bookstore owners. I would love to talk to them, like the various ones on and off campus and around Chicago. How do we start making these connections?
It's a good question. I think one of the ways to really protect bookstores is just become part of their communities. Like the more you go, the more you hang out, the more you browse, the more you go to events, you'll get to know the people who work there. There's small staffs. At the Raven, we have a couple people, a couple customers who will just like buy this one bookseller's staff pick, no matter what it is. If it's Nancy's staff pick, they'll buy it sight unseen just because they like what Nancy reads generally. So I don't think it's terribly hard to befriend and get to know bookstore staff. How I did it, the bookstore community, a lot of us know each other nationwide. We're very supportive and we stay in communication with each other. Some of my closest friends are booksellers. And so a lot of folks I knew or had been kind of paying attention to over the years. And then really fortunately, the Amazon book did really well in American bookstores. And so a lot of folks, if they didn't know me, they knew me through the book that sold well at their store. And so even if I was emailing them cold and be like, hey, I'm working on the follow-up to the Amazon book, can you talk to me? They were pretty excited about that. Like at Bookends and Beginnings in Evanston, which is another store I wrote about, there's a store that's on, they signed on to an antitrust lawsuit against Amazon. My book was their number one bestseller in 2021. And so it's like, I wanted to write about them anyway. It's not like some kind of weird tit for tat, but it's just a funny coincidence that they were familiar with me through the work. And then I showed up to do the interview. And so the support and success of the first book, I think also opened some doors for me in getting to talk to some of these folks. How did I know Louise? Louise came to do an event in Lawrence. I opened the book talking about it, but I met her when she came to Lawrence to do an event in March 2020. It was the day that COVID got really serious and the world changed. And we did one last event with Louise and we had just kept in touch after that event.
And I also want to say, we haven't been talking really about your poetry yet, but of course it doesn't hurt in terms of your book story. You've won a number of awards and you took it over in 2017. And we should say you're the principal owner, but it's also co-owned by employees, right?
Yeah, right. I'm one of several owners. And so in part, inspired by the Amazon book and thinking about different bookstore models in this bookstore book, like, okay, here's how Amazon does everything wrong. What do we need to do it right? And I really thought employee ownership, to make the ownership structure reflect the labor balance in the store, was really important. These people are so vital to the success of the store. They should share in the profits. Like the ownership structure should reflect who's actually doing the work. And so in January of 2022, we converted to employee owned and brought on some minority owners who are employees. And that's been really interesting so far. I think really rewarding.
In sociology, the third place is a space outside the home and the workplace in which we can form social relationships and share communal experiences. Third places are public spaces, but they also hold deep personalized significance, making them a kind of porous middle ground between public connections and private well-being. Bookstores, as Danny Kane has said, are such third places. But I think that bookstores also occupy another type of middle ground, another kind of edge, if you will, between the dominant social systems and the peripheral communities and ways of life that might question and react against such systems. As Danny pointed out, many third places today, including bookstores, are for-profit spaces. They imbricate themselves in the web of enormous industries and their inner workings, such as the publishing industry and the shipping industry, and the increased automation of jobs within them. More broadly, these for-profit third places are also emblematic of the pervasive ways of thinking that we use to construct and perceive our own lives. For example, we have come to structure a big part of our identities and relationships with other people through the purchase and sale of objects, products. Books, in many ways, are such a product, but I don't mean this with any bitter nostalgia for some pre-capitalist past. As Danny has written about extensively, bookstores also supply marginalized communities and movements with spaces to connect and organize against prevailing material, racial, and sexual ideologies, including that obsession with products as necessary intermediaries of human relationships or even replacements for human relationships. And the ideas in books and literature themselves are equipment for living more meaningful lives within or as resistance to powerful systems. So, bookstores can be countercultural spaces, but I think it's important to remember that they are not in themselves totally outside of the dominant culture or system. They interact with it and have to reckon with it. But unlike many other products, books do awaken the attentive reader, browser, and conversationalist to the systems that undergird and thicken our realities, and how we can reckon with or challenge their force publicly and privately. And that is immensely powerful. And now, back to the interview.
I wanted to pivot to your poetry a little bit, although we can always come back to book selling, and just a bit about your poems. One thing I really noticed about your poems, and this is the English major nerd in me coming out, a lot of your poems have this proliferation of very banal objects like headlights and like dishwashers, tennis balls, shoes, spoons, bacon, etc. They aren't personified. They don't really come alive that much. And you don't even describe them in immense detail. But there's so many of them just arranged in an interesting succession and interesting syntaxes that I really feel them people, the space of the poem. So what relationships do your poems have with objects? Like, what's your favorite object and how do objects make their way into your poems and live in them?
Oh, that's a great question. The thing that unites my poetry and the nonfiction writing is my main obsession as a writer. Like, how do you live meaningfully in late capitalism? As corporations and global capitalist forces take over the world, what does it mean to try to have a meaningful human life? And I think the proliferation of objects might reflect that. A lot of what we do in this world is just a collection of objects. And regardless of whether it's good or bad, you build a nest. And it sounds like a lot of the poems you were referencing were from Picture Window, like the tennis ball. There are a ton of billboards in that book. And I think that book in particular, I wanted to write about the domestic in a way that I hadn't written about it so far. And then the pandemic happened. And so I kind of had to write about the domestic. I was forced into this weird, uneasy, claustrophobic domesticity. And when your attention is so focused within your own home and within your own family, every object in your house takes on a new resonance. And so a tennis ball that you've never seen somehow shows up in your house. Like, that's weird. That's interesting. It's poetic. It feels dreamlike. And that's kind of the vibe I was going for with that book. In terms of food, you also mentioned bacon. I think food is a really great shortcut into politics and identity and other things. Like, food as a metaphor or an objective correlative stand-in for bigger things. It's always been a really fun entry point for me to write through food towards bigger things. And I think that happens throughout all my poetry.
I think it's time to hear one of your poems.
Yeah, I'll read from Picture Window since I mentioned it. I think judging from the title of the podcast, this one gestures towards the creative process just a little bit as well, because it talks about Annie Dillard and writing her book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. So this is called Parking Lot Pilgrim. I think a teacher once told me about Annie Dillard writing Pilgrim at Tinker Creek on note cards, then laying the note cards on her driveway to organize the book, Fighting the Wind. At least I think so. The memory runs away from me as my toddler runs away from me across the street to cover the parking lot with footprints like note cards. His uneven steps are writing a book about the bike rack, the hole, the stairs, the garden, the pond with the frogs who disappear the minute he comes stomping near, all crash and half stumble. There's nowhere else to go. I wish I could Dillard all this, uncover wonders with an elastic mind. But today my mind wants to snap like the tired ear of a paper mask. I'm afraid these frogs are nothing but splashes. The parking lot is just a parking lot.
That's beautiful. All those fragments, and then we can kind of piece together in our own mind. So what first drew you to poetry? Those, not that they're influences, but those voices that carry you along your path.
Well, Annie Dillard, like, the book Pilgrim at Tinker Creek is amazing. It's widely considered a classic of nature writing. It's got really beautiful both descriptions of the natural world and meditations on people's connections to it. And the best thing about that book to me is that Annie Dillard wrote that book in her suburban backyard. Like, she lived in a cul-de-sac. And the idea that even in the most banal suburban setting, she can find that much beauty is really inspiring to me as a poet. I think another really important writer to me is Frank O'Hara. Like, his book Lunch Poems is iconic. And at least in the conceit of that book, these are just his musings wandering around on his lunch breaks in New York City. The fact that someone can wring so much beauty from a 30-minute lunch break in a bustling city and do it in a way that feels really inviting and friendly. You just want to live in that book. And I love that. And I really love to draw influences from non-poets, too. Like, I'm really influenced by the lyrics of David Byrne from the Talking Heads. who has this way of just writing so clearly and so plainly about domestic life and falling in love and politics in a way that's just so surprising to me. His phrasing can be so simple and startling. And right now I'm in the phase of writing the new book where I'm just researching, and it feels like building a nest around me so I can safely begin to write. It's like I've got all my inspirations surrounding me in this little fort, and only when the fort is complete can I begin to actually write the book.
And this is Jewish American Dream?
Well, no, this is How to Defend Books and Why. Jewish American Dream, I think, is largely done. I've submitted it to some places. That's my new poetry collection. Even if it's not done, I had to put it on pause to hit my deadline on the nonfiction book. But yeah, the Jewish American Dream is really an attempt to invent a new kind of Jewish storytelling that's joyful and not 100% dependent on the traumas of the past. Because I think we're in a moment right now where we're seeing a lot of Jewish trauma be weaponized for political means, or very literally weaponized for violence. And I was interested in claiming a Jewish identity that's apart from that weaponization and politicization. Again, what does it mean to live meaningfully as a Jewish person in a world where Jewish identity is being weaponized for really violent means? And it is difficult. That didn't stop me from trying it. It felt really necessary. A lot of the people I'm in community in the Jewish world with are feeling really alienated from, you know, call it the mainstream Jewish response or mainstream Jewish messaging right now, and are looking for alternative modes of Jewish storytelling. And so I was like, well, I'm a poet. Every revolution needs a poet, or multiple poets, so I'll give this a shot. And again, we'll see. Some of the poems have been published, which I'm really grateful for, and some of that stuff is kind of creeping its way into the world. And hopefully I'll get a chance to share that book with the world soon, too.
I read Parking Lot Pilgrim on your website a few days ago, and I was really struck by that line, "There's nowhere else to go." I think it just comes at a kind of surprising place in the poem, and it betrays this urgency and slight desperation, but also it's very quiet and understated. I love that. And I feel like it might strike a chord with the people and booksellers and writers feeling there's nowhere else to go. And I feel like you're giving us the word to go, along with a lot of other people, of course. On a completely different note, though, you were talking about food as a way to cut to the center of politics. That's something I noticed, too, the Panacean bacon of the future and the Taco Bells outside of time. So I guess I wanted you to say more about how your poems digest these associations with food, often as a vehicle to allow you / the reader to arrive somewhere else.
I think the first time this happened was a poem I wrote really early on for my first book. And the first book is called Continental Breakfast. It ends with a sequence called Uncle Harold's Maxwell House Haggadah, which is about the corporate takeover of both Passover, the Jewish holiday, and just like life. And so I was at a grocery store on Cleveland's East Side, where a lot of the Jewish folks live, and just looking at the vast display of junk food that's kosher for Passover. And I was thinking about the kind of construction from the Haggadah. This is the bread of affliction. And I started listing all the junk food. It's like, this is the Manischewitz milk chocolate lolly cones of affliction. This is the kosher Coke of affliction. And thinking about ritual in contemporary America, where you're not giving up junk food, you're just eating a different kind of more expensive and less tasty junk food for the duration of this holiday. And that was interesting and funny to me. And I think the presence of this junk food ties into the story of Passover. And the Maxwell House Haggadah is by many means the defining ritual text for Passover in the United States. And it's like a corporate free premium. Since the 1920s, it's been like you buy enough Maxwell House coffee, you get the free Haggadah. Like this holiday has been intertwined with this giant coffee corporation. And that's interesting and complicated. And that kind of started my interest in it. And then it just kept coming up. Like, what are these things? Where are these sites where politics and identity and food meet? My third book, Flavortown, it's about the kind of vision that the Food Network feeds back to us of what authenticity should be. And what are we selling ourselves about what it means to eat via TV and a character like Guy Fieri? And how does that reflect the actual reality of what I eat every day? So yeah, I guess it's just an interest. It's a chance to go to restaurants and call it research. But mainly, I do think every culture's food is really a reflection of who they are and what they say. And there's a lot to be said, especially in the Midwest, in America, about our food ways and who we are and who we think we are.
Yeah, it reminds me of this guest we had on the podcast, I think last year. He wrote a series of poems that was based on various products in this Icelandic grocery chain, and it was sort of about eating in the body.
Oh, yes, that was Andreas Nier Magnussen.
Yes, that was him.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my poetry, I think, comes out humorous, too, and I don't have much control over it. I don't set out to be like, I'm going to explode the relationship Midwestern Americans have with food. It's just following what interests me and trying to turn it into something that's at least shaped like art. And that's one of the great parts about just reading a ton of poetry, too, is that's true of everybody. And it's really interesting to learn about people's obsessions and how they see the world through the poetry that they write. And so I think that's part of the joy, like I said, of collecting these influences. Like, man, everybody thinks so different. It's just so cool to see how they process the world through writing. I can't imagine not being curious about it, which is why the book ban thing is kind of crazy to me. To limit the perspectives that you're allowing your children to see and the sense of exploration and the sense of fun and the sense of discovery is just gone if you're only reading things that already align with everything you already know.
And finally, in closing, as you think about the future and education, the importance of the arts for opening our perspectives, maybe the teachers who were important to you, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
That's a great question. I think there is power in a supportive community. If you make helpful, supportive connections and hold each other up, there's tremendous power in that. There's power to nurture yourself. There's power to fight for a better world. And there are a lot of forces that are mobilizing against your ability to do that. And I think those forces should be resisted. Like, what is preventing you from creating authentic connections with your community? And how can you mobilize against those forces? So that's how I think of the world. And I mean, I'm really inspired by a lot of what I see with young folks, like the students at Columbia who just staged an encampment to protest Columbia's investment in the Israeli government and then were forcibly cleared by the police. Like, talk about forces that are mobilizing to prevent your ability to create a community. It's like we have the police literally bulldozing an actual community, and that's happening everywhere. But I don't want young people to give up just because of these forces, and I don't think they are. I'm very inspired by what I'm seeing. So I guess in short, it's just keep it up. You can make a better world.
Yes, definitely can. And books facilitate the exchange of knowledge and foster a culture of lifelong learning. And you've shown that. So thank you, Danny Kane, for opening our perspectives, giving us somewhere to go through your books and through your bookstore, and for your commitment to literature and celebrating the written word in the digital age, and all you do to educate and support the community of writers, readers, and booksellers. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Henny Zhang with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer and associate text editor on this episode was Henny Zhang. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk with additional production support by Sophie Garnier and Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.